the pandemic has been particularly damaging for small and medium-sized enterprise because they tend to dominate some of the most contact-intensive sectors. Now, the concern is that if insolvency rise among SMEs, they could have a significant direct macroeconomic impact, as well as implication for health to the banking sector. That's why it's important that the policy support continue to be there. My name is Fabio Natalucci. I'm a deputy director in the Monetary and Capital Markets at the IMF.
And welcome to this IMF podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. While financial systems across the globe continue to feel the pressures from the pandemic, the latest Global Financial Stability Report shows the extraordinary fiscal and monetary policy measures taken by governments, central banks, and international financial institutions have, in fact, helped pull the global economy back from the brink. Fabio Natalucci leads the team of IMF economists who produce the report. He says policymakers should continue to carefully sequence their response based on the progression of the disease to maintain the stability of the global economy. So there was a whole lot to worry about at the onset of this pandemic now more than 6 months ago. One being the financial markets and how they would react. What is your assessment of the risks so far?
I mean, the quick answer is that near-term global financial stability risks have been contained for now. We have seen unprecedented and timely policy response. That response has helped maintain the flow of credit to the economy, contain adverse macro-financial loops. And what I mean is a situation where the economy gets hit, financial conditions deteriorate, you get a feedback into the economy getting even worse, and so on. So those feedback loops have been containing those feedback loops were prevalent and pernicious during the 2008 crisis. So that allows that unprecedented and timely policy response to create a bridge to the recovery. But just to give you two numbers, in terms of, for example, central bank, the growth of central bank balance sheet, they increased by about $7.5 trillion in the G10 countries, and also about 20 emerging market central banks have deployed asset purchase for the first time. In terms of fiscal response, about $12 trillion globally has been provided to support households and corporates. Now, the result is that financial conditions have eased significantly since March. That has allowed countries and corporates to benefit from access to capital market, bank funding, and prevent liquidity pressure from turning into broad-based insolvencies. Yeah. That's the story of success. But vulnerabilities are rising, are increasing. And that raised financial stability concern and risk and put growth at risk in the medium term. So just to give you a preview of what we do in the financial stability report, we look at stretch valuation, risk asset valuation. Those are stretch, and that stretch valuation have persisted. That was a theme that we covered in the June update, despite a brief repricing in September. Then we look at vulnerabilities and found that they have increased, particularly in the non-financial corporate sector, where firms have taken on more debt to cope with cash shortages, and in the sovereign sector where fiscal deficit and increasing debt have been put in place to support the economy. And so the risk going forward essentially is that those corporate liquidity pressure may turn into insolvency, particularly if the recovery is delayed.
So the stock market is one thing that has certainly continued to surprise people. We did speak of a disconnect between what was, you know, the prices in the stock market and what was actually happening on the street back in April, and that persists. Do you worry that this market rebound has gone too far?
Yeah, so globally, equity markets have rebounded from March lows, like a very sharp rebound. That despite subdued economic activity and very uncertain economic outlook. There are notable differentiation across countries, depending on the spread of the virus and the scope of policy support. There are also differentiation in terms of what the pandemic means for different sectors. Right. So, for example, sectors like airlines, hotels, energy, financials have been more affected by lockdown and social distances, while other sectors that are less contact intensive, like information technology, communication, those have been faring much better. Now, at this point, valuations still appear stretched in equity market, despite the correction in the tech sector in September. And so the disconnect between the evolution of the real economy and the assessment of risk in financial market that we highlighted back in June is still there. Now, the question is like, what factors may be driving this disconnect? Some factor may be related to the compositional, to sectoral composition of equity indices and investor base. So, for example, The US stock market has been boosted by a large share of tech firms in the S&P 500. The pandemic had a different implication in terms of work and consumption behavior in terms of new technologies. Some countries, we have seen retail investors that traditionally they tend to chase growth and technology stock, that they have significantly increased their participation in the stock market. And so they probably provided support to equity prices. And then third factor is policy support, right? So the fact that central banks and authorities have stepped in to cushion the economy from the impact of the pandemic clearly helped the rebound in investor sentiment, specifically expectation that the policy support may continue going forward. Now, the question was, has the stock market rebound gone too far? Now, if you look at IMF equity valuation model, those models suggest that overvaluation are now at historically high levels in a number of countries. Now, so the risk here is that the policy action that has been so beneficial to cushion the economy may have unintended consequences beyond the policymaker objective, which was easing financial conditions, supporting investor sentiment, and keeping markets open. Now, it's very difficult from an analytical standpoint to separate intended from unintended consequences. And so the question looking forward, I think, is that risk asset valuation, in fact, may remain elevated for some time, as long as there is a perception in markets that policy support will be there. At the same time, though, there's a risk of a sharp adjustment in asset prices or possible periodic bouts of volatility, especially if the recovery is delayed. Right? So possible triggers for this repricing could be, as I said, a delayed recovery, could be a reassessment on the part of investor of the extent and duration of policy support, or geopolitical event like Brexit, for example. And so at the time of the recording of this podcast, we were a few days away from the Brexit negotiation deadline. So there's a lot of focus in markets on how this negotiation may, in fact, conclude.
And so with interest rates expected to remain low, at least for the foreseeable future, is the appetite for risk-taking on the part of investors seen as a big risk for the broader financial system?
The rebound in risk appetite since March 23rd has been widespread across risk assets, so that's affected equity, credit, and has been instrumental in easing financial condition, so cushioning the economy from the impact of the pandemic. Now, the rebound in risk-taking, in part, it's a policy objective, right? The idea is to ease financial condition, help the economy cope with the pandemic. The question here is about, as I said, unintended consequences. And so whether institutional investor or investor more generally have become accustomed to policy support. This is what in markets is the widely discussed central bank market. How much of this risk-taking behavior is in fact driven by the belief, whether that's a correct belief or not, but the belief that central bank may step in and provide a floor to asset prices.
And in that same vein, big investment funds are now looking at growing debt in many countries as a desirable asset. Is that a potential risk? Or are these non-bank financial institutions on firmer ground than they were when we spoke back in April?
Yeah, so the pandemic has exposed some vulnerabilities in non-bank financial institutions. Right? The example is asset manager, for example, and liquidity mismatch. So those funds that they provide daily liquidity, but they invest in very liquid assets. Now, they managed to cope with market turmoil at this point, thanks to policy support, but there are still evident fragilities in the non-bank financial institution sector. For example, non-bank financial institutions now play a much more important role in credit markets in advanced economies, particularly in riskier segments. Also, the extremely low yield environment, compressed market volatility, and the perception that policymakers will continue to backstop key financial markets are likely to create incentive for financial releveraging. So returns are getting squeezed, so one way to boost return is to use financial leverage. Another interesting point is that asset correlation has stayed very high. Right? That means that in some sense, some of the assets that traditionally they're being used as edge because they're not very correlated with others, now they tend to move together. So the risk with higher correlation is that that could increase contagion risk. And if there is a shock, those losses could be propagated by investor portfolios during abrupt price correction. So I think the bigger picture and the big question here is that the links between corporates, banks, and non-bank financial institutions is increasing. But that means that if there is, in the event of a stress, that fragility could amplify a shock. It could spread the impact to the entire financial system. So this issue of interconnectedness is an issue that we are paying particular attention now.
And should we worry about the level of debt that countries have taken on during this crisis?
So I think we focus on two type of debt. One, it's like non-financial corporate debt, and then sovereign. In terms of non-financial corporate, those firms enter the pandemic with already elevated vulnerabilities. I think we discussed in previous podcasts this. If you look at the systemic 29 economies, those that enter with high or medium high corporate sector vulnerabilities were close to 80% by GDP before the crisis, already before the crisis.
Yeah.
So subsequent to the crisis, cash flow took a hit, the economic activity declined. So more vulnerable firms, those with like weaker solvency, weaker liquidity position, or smaller, those are the ones that experience greater financial distress compared to the larger one. Now, the large firm could have access to capital markets, right? So they stepped up bond issuance, they increased borrowing from banks, including lines of credit, and they managed to cope with cash shortages that way. So in all likelihood, without policy support, the reopened market facilitated borrowing, non-financial firm now would have seen clearly a sharper rise in bankruptcy. Now, the problem is that this increase of corporate debt has added to already elevated debt levels, in part in a number of countries. Yeah. And so the risk is that going forward, especially if the recovery is delayed, this liquidity pressure may morph into insolvency. And so increased borrowing has so far mitigated a large increase in defaults, but if they could down the road lead to a deterioration in repayment capacity, that could put solvency at risk. We have seen, for example, credit quality already showing signs of deterioration in terms of credit rated downgrades, those initially spiked, as well as speculative grade defaults rose quickly, although the pace has now slowed. Now, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that the crisis is also expected to push higher global public debt above 100% of GDP in 2020. That would be the largest level ever, because large fiscal measure plus the sharp decline in output, so numerator goes up, the denominator goes down, clearly has led to a rapid expansion of sovereign debt. In fact, at the end of the first quarter of 2020, public debt has reached historical highs in most systemically important economies, and fiscal deficit are expected to increase and be large this year.
And so the smaller businesses have been hit really hard from the beginning of the lockdowns. And as you mentioned, the financial support, the fiscal support that they've seen, that many businesses have seen, have managed to keep them alive, or at least many of them alive so far. What happens if they lose that support before the economies can reopen?
So the future path of default and bankruptcy would depend critically on, one, the evolution of the pandemic. And so that has implication for the overall economic outlook. And two, on the policymaker capacity or ability to maintain accommodative conditions, so to provide support to viable firms, right? SMEs are more vulnerable than the larger one, right? They tend to have less diversified revenues. They have limited access to capital markets and financing options, a low liquidity buffer, and thinner equity to absorb loss. In addition to that, that's the initial condition, if you want. In addition to that, the pandemic has been particularly damaging for small and medium-sized enterprises because they tend to dominate some of the most contact-intensive sectors, like hotels, restaurants, entertainment. Now, the concern is that if insolvencies rise among SMEs, they could have a significant direct macroeconomic impact, as well as implications for health to the banking sector. Right? And that's going back to the macro-financial linkages that I mentioned before. Why is that the case? One is because SMEs, they account for a very large share of employment, right? For example, in Europe, SMEs account for about half of total output and two-thirds of employment. And two, because SMEs rely almost entirely on bank financing. And so that link and the borrowing from banks could become a source of vulnerability, particularly for regional and smaller banks. That's why it's important that the policy support continue to be there. So as the economies reopen, continued monetary policy accommodation and targeted liquidity support remain essential to sustain the recovery. And regulators should continue to encourage banks to use capital and liquidity buffer to continue lending. Now, once the pandemic is fully under control, at that point, we can start discussing the extent to which and the pace at which policy support may be gradually withdrawn. And the policy support should be, in terms of monetary policy, maintaining accommodative policy until the objective of central bank are achieved. In terms of liquidity support, gradually withdraw liquidity to encourage a return to market discipline. In terms of credit provision, require banks to gradually rebuild capital and liquidity buffer and develop plans to deal with problem assets. In terms of the non-corporate financial sector, we need a framework to think in terms of recapitalization need, restructuring, or need to resolve viable firms. And then two more, that a more like medium-term horizon, strengthening the regulatory perimeter for non-bank financial institutions, as we discussed before. Then finally, stepping up this prudential supervision to contain excessive risk-taking in an environment of lower for longer interest rate that is going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
And at what point does all the money and support that governments are providing to keep their economies going become a liability? What are the trade-offs that governments will have to make in the coming weeks and months ahead?
So policymakers face a very difficult trade-off now between short-term support to the economy, as I said, so easing financial conditions, maintaining the credit flow to the economy, to borrowers, to firms and households, and medium-term macro-financial stability risk, some of which we just discussed. Essentially, it's a trade-off between the support that is needed today and the implication of rising vulnerabilities for growth in the medium term. And this trade-off is evident across sectors, right? Just to give you a few examples. We discussed the corporate sector, right? Policy measures have allowed firms to address liquidity pressure today by increasing borrowing, keeping bankruptcy at bay. But many of these firms already entered the pandemic with high level of debt, and corporate debt is going to go up even more. So liquidity pressure, as I mentioned before, the risk is that liquidity pressure put MRF into insolvency if the recovery is delayed. Banking is another example of this trade-off, right? The resilience of the banking sector is likely to be tested. So far, banks have been part of the solution. As I mentioned, there's been bank lending has continued, and the banking sector has entered the crisis with stronger capital and liquidity buffer than during the financial crisis in 2008-2009. Now, that strength reflects the reforms that have been put in place post-financial crisis, and that strength has allowed banks to continue to provide credit. Now, that said, in adverse macroeconomic scenarios, we find that there is a weak tail of banks that could suffer a significant capital shortfall. Another example is the non-bank financial institution. We have seen they play a more important role in credit markets. They have done fine so far, but that increased links between corporates, bank, and non-bank financial institution, as I said, implies that this fragility could become an amplifier or a shock and spread to the financial system. And then emerging markets, they also require policy attention. In some frontier economies, they face financing challenges, clearly benefited emerging markets as an asset class from the easing of global financial conditions, improved the outlook for portfolio flows. We have seen a rebound in portfolio flows, but there are some countries that still have not regained access to capital markets. And some of these countries are heavily indebted. They face prohibitive borrowing costs and may face distress. So to summarize, policymakers face challenging trade-off between short-term support today, medium-term macro-financial stability risk tomorrow, and it's crucial at this point that policymakers closely monitor any potential unintended consequences of their unprecedented support that they have cushioned the economy from the pandemic.
Fabio Natalucci, always a pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to our next conversation in the spring.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Fabio Natalucci is Deputy Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department and Head of the Global Financial Stability Report. You can read the full report at imf.org. Look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.